page front and back to 12 pages or more front and back during my time in the business. In addition to a 12-page purchase, a sale agreement may include a 5-page disclosure and another dozen pages of addendums that cover items not discussed in the contract. Know what a contract requires and when it puts you in harm's way, then modify it so it protects you. Make your offers as clear and concise as possible, and you will buy bargains that others miss. Some contract clauses are enforceable after the closing. Parts of the contract may survive or be enforceable even after the closing. A seller benefits by not having any continuing obligations or liabilities after the closing. When you are the seller, be aware of these potential ongoing obligations. As a buyer, you would like the seller to be responsible if a problem previously unknown to you arises after the closing. Common warranties and promises that a seller would make that would survive the closing are: seller is conveying the property free of all mechanics, liens, and other claims. Seller warrants that information in the listing agreement or otherwise provided is correct to the best of his knowledge. Seller warrants that he has disclosed to the buyer all material latent defects that are known to him. Seller warrants that he has disclosed any information in his possession that materially and adversely affects the consideration paid by the buyer. In addition, the right to require specific performance to force the other party to close as agreed in the contract survives to both the buyer and seller unless modified in the contract. Although buyers commonly rely on representations made by agents, note this paragraph from a realtor's contract. Buyer agrees to rely solely on seller, professional inspectors, and governmental agencies for verification of property condition, square footage, and facts that materially affect property value, and not on the representations, oral, written, or otherwise, of broker. This paragraph puts buyers on notice not to rely on the agent's statements. Asking the seller to write it down. When an offer is accepted by a seller in a hurry, and he agreed to a price or terms favorable to you, have the seller write it down in its most basic form to show that he understands the offer. I, John Seller, accept Barb Buyer's offer to purchase my house at 2357 Prime Street for a price of $100,000 with $10,000 down and the balance payable at $500 a month, including interest of 3% until paid in full, closing on May 1, 2016. The buyers agree to pay all closing costs. You can take a simple contract like this and fill in the blanks to reflect your understanding, and all can sign it. In review, a contract that will close will reflect a meeting of the minds. When both want to close, they will do so. And if either party does not want to close, it is better to look for another deal rather than try to force this deal to close. You never want to go to court. Your contract does not have to be enforceable in a court. An agreement written on the back of an envelope will close if both parties want to close. Have a clear agreement that covers the important points and then close as soon as is practical. I often try to close in less than a week. Negotiate patiently and don't worry about losing the deal, but once you have an agreement, close quickly. If the sellers have agreed to sell to you at a bargain price or on good terms, someone else may offer them more. Closing sooner reduces this possibility. Filling out the contract is part of the negotiation process. Go slowly, one point at a time, and see how the seller reacts. You will learn a lot about how a seller negotiates. You can negotiate the points most important to you last when you have a feel for how the seller negotiates. Always have a way out. Just one good loophole is all you need. Always be willing to walk away. Never make it personal. If they won't close, walking out of a closing sometimes brings them back to the table. Chapter 11. Making the Offer. Talk with the sellers before you make an offer. After you have completed the buying strategy worksheet, see Figure 4.1, sit down with the sellers and talk about what is important to them. You know what you are willing to pay. Now is the time to see if you can get an idea of why they are selling. The why may give you a clue as to how anxious they are to sell and how soon they need to sell. Make sure that you are talking to the decision makers. If a husband and wife own the house, have both of them at the table. If there is another decision maker, such as a relative or an attorney, it is best to first make the deal with the sellers and then make that deal subject to review by the third party. Understand the seller's motivation before you make the offer. Ask the sellers, "Why are you selling such a nice house?" Then listen. Write down on a blank sheet of paper what reason you think you heard them say is important to them. Then show it to them to see if you heard them correctly. This may include a fast closing, a certain amount of money that they need at closing to relocate or rent another house, the relief from their current monthly payments, or money for other obligations. If they have other obligations that are bothering them, for example, credit card bills, student tuition due, and so on, have them list them. There are two reasons to have them list these obligations. One, many times they do not know exactly what they owe. One spouse may have borrowed money that the other spouse is not aware of. Two, there may be times when you can take the responsibility for paying off an obligation as part of your purchase price. If the seller owes money to a contractor, an attorney, a hospital, or a creditor whom he is not currently paying, you may be able to work out a repayment plan with the creditor. Instead of paying the creditor all cash, you can pay a monthly amount, often without interest. Sometimes a creditor will agree to take less than is owed. Tips for when you are buying. Let the seller make the first offer. When you are trying to get the best price, you want the other party to set his highest price first, before you make an offer. This will provide you with the most you will have to pay for a property. Sometimes it is a great price, and you won't have to negotiate. Typically, this number is close to a retail price or even higher. House sellers often ask for more than they expect, hoping to get lucky. Setting a price too high is not a good selling strategy because it will turn off most buyers. If you are the buyer, the price is only one of many things that you will negotiate. Some other items include the condition of the house, the personal property that will go with the house, the closing date, who will pay the closing costs, and the terms of any owner financing. You want to reach agreement on these and other issues that may come up as part of the offer-making process. Picking the price for your offer. As the buyer, your offer should be at a low enough price or with such good terms that you will be very happy if the seller accepts. If you are not at least a little embarrassed by your first offer, you are offering too much. You should fall off your chair if they take it. And sometimes they do. Plan ahead in order to make your offer good for you. Don't be overly concerned about what the sellers will accept. They will let you know if you are too low. It is good strategy to ask for more than you really need to make the deal. The exception would be when buying from a distressed seller, which is covered later. Most sellers set the sales price a little high, anticipating that a buyer will make a lower offer. They may have a bottom line price in mind. Research what other comparable houses have sold for recently, and then compare the price of this house with those prices. Adjust the price for differences in condition or size, and then make your first offer below what you need to buy the house for to make a profit. Suppose that a seller is asking for $250,000. And after researching the neighborhood, you find that other comparable houses have sold for between $200,000 and $240,000, and that those houses were in better shape than the seller's. You determine that the seller's house is really worth between $200,000 and $220,000. Sometimes houses are on the market for years because they are overpriced. These houses can be opportunities because the seller eventually becomes more motivated to sell and the market values catch up with her high price. You decide that you would like to buy this house for about $175,000, and the owner wants $250,000. The house is vacant and needs cosmetic repairs and has been on the market for a year. your first offer should be $160,000. Offer number one. Never, never, never try to think for the seller. Make your first offer an offer that you know will make you money and see how she responds. At $160,000, you know you have a bargain. Offer number two. It often takes more than one offer to get an acceptance. The seller may counter your offer with a different price and terms you can counter back, or she could make a different offer entirely. How do you decide which approach to take? If, after you make your first offer, the seller makes a big move in your direction, then stick with your strategy and move a little, or sometimes not at all, on your price and terms. After your $160,000 offer, she tells you how much she has spent fixing up the house and how the neighbors down the street just sold a smaller house for $275,000, both fiction. Then she counters with $225,000. By coming down $25,000, she shows that she is open to another offer. So you offer $165,000, but say that is absolutely as high as you can go. She wrings her hands and says that little Johnny will have to wait to go to college and counters with her final offer of $200,000. You thank her for compromising, but say that this is the most you have ever paid for a house in this neighborhood. However, you are willing to split the difference with her and pay $175,000 if she will include the appliances. She sighs and agrees. Offer number three. However, what if, after your first offer, she counters at $245,000? With that small of a move, she is unlikely to get down to your price. So take a different approach. Offer her $175,000 with $10,000 down and the balance payable at $1,000 a month, including 3% interest. That gives her a higher interest rate than she can earn in a bank. You would have researched the income and expenses and would know that the house will produce a net income of conservatively $1,100 a month, giving you a very acceptable $100 a month cash flow on your $10,000 investment. Stop and think about these last two offers. If you could have either one accepted today, which would you choose? Whichever you choose, make that type of offer first, next time. For a full day of negotiation strategies, study my course, Negotiation Secrets of a Professional Buyer. Further details on this can be found on my website, www.johnschaub.com. You can always improve as a negotiator, and improving pays well. Don't let a seller shop your offer. When a seller uses your offer to solicit a higher offer from someone else, it is called shopping your offer. While this is good for the seller, it's not good for you. Real estate brokers who represent the seller will sometimes try to get two buyers to bid against each other to get the seller a higher price and to earn a higher commission. You can avoid people shopping your offer by making an offer that has to be accepted or rejected in a short period of time. An offer can contain a clause that states that the seller must respond by a certain time and date, for example, by 5 p.m. on July 1, 2016. If you are making an offer directly to a seller, ask him or her before you make the offer, "Are you ready to sell your house today?" Then make an offer. The seller needs to accept it or make a counteroffer now or within a few hours. Never give sellers several days to think it over. They will use those days to get a higher offer from someone else. Tell the sellers that the offer is good today and today only. If they don't accept, your offer is off the table. If they come back to you later and want to sell, you can reconsider, but you won't guarantee to pay this much. You can add strength to this statement by telling them about another house you are looking at and saying that you cannot afford to buy them both. Tell them that you like their house better and are making them your first offer, but if they don't accept it, you will then try to buy the other house. Counteroffers. Dee Fountain was a successful agent who insisted that a seller make a counteroffer and did it with a smile so that the sellers were encouraged to make some concession to keep the deal alive. Don't tell me what you won't do. Tell me what you will do. When a seller refuses your offer, ask, "Would you buy this house today for what I am offering you?" If he turns down your offer, he has, in effect, just bought his house for that amount. He could have had your money instead of his house. Never give a seller a big deposit. When you make an offer, you typically show that you are serious by including a deposit with the contract. Do not give the seller this deposit. Make your check out to an attorney or title company who will handle the closing. If you need to gain credibility with the sellers by showing them that you have the money necessary to buy their house, you could bring a cashier's check payable to your attorney or title company with you and attach it to your offer. This check does not need to be for the full down payment. A check for $1,000 should be enough to show that you are serious. If you are agreeing to close within a short period of time, a week or two, agree to make the deposit with the attorney or title company within 48 hours after they have accepted your offer. If you are signing a contract on a weekend, you typically have to wait until Monday morning before you can give the attorney or title company your check. This gives you time to raise the down payment if you don't have the money, and a way out of the deal if you change your mind. The language in your offer will determine who gets the earnest money and what happens with it in the event that either the buyer or the seller fails to close. Use language that protects you. The contract may state that you are entitled to a refund of your deposit if you don't close because of certain reasons, for instance, an inability to finance the property. It may state that the sellers can keep your deposit as liquidated damages if you don't close, but that is all that they can have, and that you have no other liability. The language in a broker's contract is more likely to favor the seller and the broker over the potential buyer. If a real estate agent is involved, the agent will want to hold the deposit. Give the agent the smallest amount possible. $100 is sufficient if you are agreeing to close in a week or two. Both the seller and the broker will want more deposit money if the closing date is months away. How to use a home inspector as a safety net. Hiring a home inspector to give a potential purchase a good look is a great idea. A home inspector should check out all the major systems such as plumbing, electrical, heat, air conditioning, and the structure and roof. Meet him at the house and walk around with him. Don't pester him with too many questions, but watch him work and learn from watching. You will learn a few tricks that you can use yourself. He will give you a written report that you can then use to negotiate with the seller in the event that you find a previously undisclosed problem with the house. If you have already negotiated a great deal, don't be foolish and ask for more if the problems you discover are small. Your counteroffer will let him out of the obligation to sell to you, and he may then sell to another buyer for more money. Instead of negotiating over small items, use the home inspection as an insurance policy against major problems that you might otherwise miss. If you are having second thoughts about buying the house after reading the inspection, this means that you have not made a great deal and that you should ask for more concessions from the seller. If this does happen, you should be willing to risk the deal getting away. How to handle a seller who wants a third party to approve a contract. Sometimes a seller will want his or her attorney or a family member to look over or approve a contract. Often this is done because the seller does not understand the contract. This is why you should try to make your offers as simple as possible. If the seller still insists on having a third party involved, use language that keeps the deal together unless the third party can introduce new information that influences the seller's decision. For example, with an attorney, insert a clause that says, "This transaction will close as agreed unless attorney," enter the attorney's name, "notifies both the buyer and seller in writing within 3 days stating how the contract is not in compliance with current statutes and regulations." Never say that it is subject to the approval of an attorney or anyone else. No attorney would ever put his stamp of approval on anything that might subject him to liability. Dealing with owners who are not at the table. If you are negotiating with one party in a divorce, one heir to an estate, or one partner in a partnership that is splitting up, then make your offer subject to being able to buy out the other party on terms agreeable to you. This will be a totally separate negotiation. You can pay a different price or buy on different terms. With a property that has multiple owners in title, often one will need cash today and will be willing to accept less money if he or she gets it now. Another owner will hold out for a higher price but be willing to accept terms. Although these negotiations take more time, they also have more potential for profit. Of course, you need to make any purchase of a partial interest subject to being able to buy the rest of the property. A partial interest is hard to sell, and it can be expensive to force another partial owner to sell. Four secrets to getting your offer accepted. Sellers are more likely to accept an offer that they understand, gives them instant or near-instant gratification, and requires them to do little work. 1. First, keep your offer simple. Avoid long, complicated contracts. Sellers will refuse to sign them simply because they can't understand them. Sellers need to know how much money they are going to get and when they are going to get it. Be as specific and clear as possible on these two points. 2. Second, make a net offer with you paying all the closing costs. Know what your closing costs will be and calculate them into your offer. This gives the seller the answer to, how much money will I get? 3. Third, offer to buy the house in as-is condition. This allows the seller to leave the house without doing any work. By taking all the risk, you can increase your profit. Of course, you need to either inspect the house thoroughly before you make the offer or make the inspection a contingency in your contract. Even with an as-is offer, you can require the seller to leave the house in its current condition without further damage. Walk through the house before you close to make sure that it is in the same condition as it was when you inspected it. If there is additional damage, you can renegotiate the price to compensate for it. 4. Finally, offer to close quickly. Sellers will often accept lower offers that close sooner. They are selling because they need money now. If they could wait, they could sell for more. If you can incorporate all these items into your offers, you will buy more houses and further below the market. The checklist that follows will take you step by step through the process of finding, negotiating, and closing your first deal. Use it for every house you buy. 1. Identify a potential bargain purchase. Ask questions. 2. Write down the one urgent problem you can solve for the seller. 3. Establish the fair market value, give or take 5%. 4. Research the market rent and likely net income the property will produce. 5. State your minimum acceptable profit on this house. 6. Formulate an offer that solves the seller's one urgent problem. 7. Make the offer. Insist on either an acceptance or a counteroffer. Remember, don't tell me what you won't do. Tell me what you will do. 8. Make another offer based on any new information. 9. If the seller is unresponsive, but you remain convinced there is opportunity, go away and come back in a week with another offer. 10. Get the contract accepted and signed by all parties. 11. Make your earnest money deposit with the closing agent. 12. Retain rights to use a house inspector and termite inspector if needed. 13. Order a title search with a title company, attorney, or escrow company, and furnish these agents with a copy of your fully signed contract. 14. Talk with the agent or attorney who will prepare the closing documents to alert him or her to any unusual clauses in the contract. 15. Get copies of any documents you will be required to sign the day before the closing and get a copy of the title insurance commitment. Read them to check for exceptions. 16. Read closing documents very carefully. 17. Walk through the house the day of the closing after the sellers are completely out of the house. 18. Go to the closing, review the documents, and collect the appropriate items listed on the closing documents list and get the keys and garage door opener. Note: when you are buying, take your time. Time is on your side. having both the buyers and the sellers at the closing can work to your advantage. When you are selling, sign documents in advance. Only go to pick up your check after the buyer has signed everything and left. Chapter 12. Secrets of Professional Negotiators. You are a negotiator. We all are. Some are better than others because they have learned from their experience how others react to certain offers. You can level the playing field with these good negotiators by recognizing their techniques and being prepared for any negotiation that involves a lot of money. A penny saved is a penny earned. Benjamin Franklin. I suspect that Benjamin Franklin was an excellent negotiator. He understood that saving a penny when you buy something is the equivalent of earning that same penny, and that was before we had an income tax. Today, when you save $10,000 because you buy something at a below-market price, you have saved even more than the discount you made. To pay the extra dollar to buy something, you first have to earn that dollar plus the tax you owe on it. Saving $10,000 when you buy something is the equivalent of earning the $10,000 plus tax. Real estate investors understand this concept and use their skills to buy properties at large discounts that are tax-free to the buyers unless they decide to sell. Two of my students use this idea to significantly reduce the amount of tax they pay while at the same time increasing their yearly profits. These high-income individuals choose to reduce the number of hours they work at their normal professions. This reduces their taxable earned income and taxes that they owe. They then use the time they are not working at their jobs to buy property at bargain prices. They may earn $100,000 working part-time and then buy several properties at a discount of even more than $100,000 during the hours that they spend as buyers. The discount they earn is untaxed until they sell the property, if ever. Plus, the properties they buy grow in value untaxed until they sell. Learning to become a fair but good negotiator. If you are going to buy, sell, and manage real estate, then you need to learn to negotiate. As you become good at it, you will make a lot more money. Negotiation is probably the most valuable skill that you can acquire. Negotiating has a bad reputation. It is not the art of taking advantage of someone else. It is the art of putting a deal together. An important element in negotiating for a house, especially one that you would like to buy with owner financing, is developing trust with the seller. If you are truthful in your statements, if you don't try to manipulate him with emotional statements, he will then be more willing to trust you as you negotiate. Some sellers never sell because they have no skills in getting a buyer to commit to buy, even when it would be very good for the buyer. Landlords have vacant houses because they never get potential tenants to commit to renting. Negotiating is a skill you can acquire, although many people seem to be born with it. Take a 3-year-old to a store, and you will experience how a persistent negotiator, one who won't take no for an answer, can get what he wants. There are several secrets that successful negotiators use to reach an agreement. Notice I did not say to win, but to reach an agreement. Unless both parties to a negotiation receive some benefit, the deal generally will fall apart, with one party failing to perform as agreed. One-sided deals often fall apart before closing. An example of a failed negotiation is when a salesperson uses an emotional argument to get a buyer to sign a contract. Such a close might be that this house is offered way below the market value and that another buyer is on his way over to sign a contract. If you want to buy it, you need to make an offer right now or it will be gone. After a contract is signed under this kind of pressure, the buyer may check out other houses for sale and learn that the house that he bought was not a bargain. He would then do what he could to get out of the contract, using excuses such as a lack of financing or deficiencies in the property for not buying. Another example is a buyer who drives a hard bargain with a builder and negotiates such a good price that the builder cannot build the house at a profit. The builder may then cut corners during the construction, delivering an inferior house, or simply refuse to build the house. Some people are quick to hire an attorney to enforce their rights under a one-sided contract. The argument is that once everyone agreed, then every party should be forced to comply. Hiring an attorney and going to court to enforce a contract, however, is rarely a profitable adventure. If you find that you have negotiated a one-sided deal and determine that the other party cannot perform reasonably, then reopen the negotiations. See if you can negotiate a deal that will work. If you consider the cost of both sides hiring an attorney and going to court, it is far cheaper to give a few dollars on each side to make the deal work. In addition, going to court will delay your closing and take a lot of your time. The total cost makes suing someone to enforce a contract that was one-sided to begin with an expensive misadventure. There are many approaches you can take to a negotiation. Figure 12.1 presents four examples of results that are somewhat predictable, depending on the approach that you take. Here are the outcomes for each of these types of negotiations. Figure 12.1, Negotiation Matrix. I win, you lose. You lose, I lose. You win, I lose. I win, you win. I win, you lose. You are buying from a seller who is short on time and resources and must sell. You make the seller a low take-it-or-leave-it offer. The seller takes it but goes away mad. Another example may be when you are dealing with another professional negotiator, such as a lawyer, a banker, or a realtor. You know you have the advantage and use it to make a profit. It's not personal, just business. An example may be when you find a property in foreclosure and recognize that a bank will lose a significant amount of money unless it makes a deal today. You make the bank a low offer, which it accepts for a small loss, but recovers most of the money it loaned. You lose, I lose. When one party in the negotiation has most of the power, typically the party with the money, then that party can over-leverage the other party by making an offer that so offends the other party that he won't take it or continue negotiations. A take-it-or-leave-it low offer to a homeowner who is behind in his payments is an example. You win, I lose. Sometimes it is wise to lose a negotiation. I had a long-term tenant call me to ask if I would pay for half the cost of the paint if he would provide the labor to repaint the interior of several rooms. I said no, that I would not pay for half the paint. I would pay for all of it if the tenant would use my favorite color, antique white. I often lose negotiations with good customers that I could easily win, because by losing, I enhance our long-term relationship, and that relationship is often very profitable. I win, you win. When a seller is under a lot of pressure to sell, you make her an offer that allows you to make a reasonable profit, but leaves her enough money to move and rent another home to live in, and you also give her the time to move. Questions to ask before you negotiate. 1. Is the person with whom I am negotiating able to make a binding decision? If not, ask who can make that final decision and negotiate with that person. With smaller transactions, such as a purchase at a store or when borrowing money at a bank or buying a car, you typically are dealing with an employee, not an owner. The owner would have authority to negotiate and make a binding decision. An employee may have some negotiating authority, but typically will seek approval before making a commitment. When borrowing from a bank, the banker who interviews you when you apply for a loan may give you the indication that he will make you the loan, but typically he will need the approval of the loan committee, which may be a committee of one, the boss. Bankers typically have a certain loan authority, the amount that they are authorized to lend without further approval. The higher you move up in the bank hierarchy, the larger the loan authority, until at some level a real committee would approve the transaction. When you are buying or selling a house, you are often dealing with a married couple or sometimes two partners who own a house together. The decision to buy or sell is typically a joint decision, and you need to involve both parties in the negotiation because they both will have to sign the contract. One person may be the decision maker. When you identify the decision maker, it may not be the one doing all of the talking. Ask him or her what it would take to make a deal today. 2. Is it worth my time to negotiate? Although some people consider it fun to negotiate for everything rather than trying to talk a store clerk into giving you a discount on a loaf of bread, save your energy for the purchase where you can save several dollars or hundreds or thousands of dollars. Once you reach 50, you should not have to negotiate for everything. Jimmy Buffett, a pirate turns 50. Most day-to-day negotiations involve little potential to make a profit. Plan ahead to be well prepared for the bigger negotiations that are worth hundreds or thousands of dollars to you. By being prepared for the big negotiations, you will profit considerably, allowing you to follow Jimmy Buffett's advice. 3. How will this negotiation affect my relationship with this person, company, and are future negotiations with this person, company, likely to be important? Many negotiations lead to another negotiation. The first interaction sets the stage for the second. Those with whom you negotiate can be a source of referrals or result in lost business. If you aim to be a long-term success in your business, then positive referrals can be a large part of your business. When you rent to a tenant, the tenant has the potential to be a source of income to you for a long time. The tenant also may refer other friends to you or steer others away from you. How you negotiate with this tenant will affect how she treats your house and what she tells others about you as a landlord. Many of my tenants have been referred to me by other tenants. This is not because I am a pushover, but because I deliver a good house at a fair price and I'm predictable in how I respond to tenant requests. McDonald's has built a billion-dollar business not because its food is the cheapest or even the tastiest, but because its food is predictable. You know what you are going to get. I have built my tenant management business using the same principle: fair and predictable. No surprises. It works. 4. Is this the best time and place to negotiate? When you are the buyer, you get to choose when and where to negotiate the purchase. You want to be well prepared and in good shape both physically and mentally before you begin the negotiation. Have a good meal, be well rested, and take plenty of time to think through what you plan to say. Only when you are at your best and well prepared should you negotiate for tens of thousands of dollars. You want to have a plan. If things are not going according to your plan, take a break and regroup. When you are the buyer, you are in control of the situation. Walking away and then starting again can work in your favor as the buyer. The seller will see you as a serious buyer when you come back, and you can pick up the negotiation where you left off last time. Although I close some properties within a week, I often take weeks and occasionally months to buy other properties. I visit with the owners a number of times, and each meeting moves me a little closer toward my goal. Where to negotiate? When you are buying a family's home, it is better to negotiate the purchase somewhere other than in the home, for many reasons. The first reason is distractions. Their home is full of distractions, from kids and pets to perhaps the neighbors dropping by. If you are going to make an offer in their home, you need to take charge of the situation and eliminate as many distractions as possible. One of my students is a very successful buyer and often buys sitting at the seller's kitchen table. To eliminate distractions, he first pulls the for sale sign out of the yard and puts it alongside the house. Once inside, he takes charge of the situation by turning off the TV and asking the sellers to turn off their cell phones. He wants to reduce the distractions while he is buying the house. If the sellers object to this, he knows that they don't want to sell to him that day. I prefer to ask the sellers to meet me outside their home. I ask them to bring their file on the home, including their purchase documents, current insurance and tax bills, and a current loan statement. This is asking a lot of these possible sellers, and it is a test. If the sellers are only mildly interested in selling, then they will decline my offer. If they really want to sell, they will meet me with all their information. Because I am a wholesale buyer, I only want to meet with sellers who are ready to sell and need to sell now. Look for an office you might have access to because of other business that you do, such as a conference room at the bank or a title or escrow company. This more professional setting has advantages over a coffee shop, such as copy machines, but a coffee shop can work. When I teach classes on buying property, my students actually find sellers and make them offers. Many of those offers have been made in coffee shops or 24-hour restaurants, and hundreds of successful negotiations are concluded there. Before you negotiate, secrets of professional negotiators. 1. Know the value before you make an offer. Based on the rental survey you conducted, you will know how much rent the prospective tenants will pay, and therefore how much you can afford to borrow and repay if you buy this house. You also will have tracked comparable houses that have sold and be able to establish a price range within 10%. 2. Negotiate for the things that are least important to you first. You may begin by negotiating for the appliances. If the sellers won't agree to include the appliances, you may adjust your strategy to continue to ask for several minor items, such as making repairs to the house or a delayed closing date. It's okay to lose on these issues, but wait to negotiate the issues that are more important to you last. At that point, you have reached agreement on many issues, and the sellers will have a lot of time and emotion invested in selling you their house. You can use the momentum created because you have made concessions to conclude the negotiation at a price and on terms acceptable to you. 3. Invoke the doctrine of fairness. One of the best negotiators I know is Jim Napier. One of his favorite negotiating techniques is to raise the issue of fairness when it appears that one party is taking unfair advantage of the situation. An example might be when one party continues to prevail on every issue. After one side wins on several issues, it only seems fair that the other side should win something. Jimmy would ask, "Is that fair?" When they asked for an explanation, he would review all the points of negotiation that he had conceded on and then ask, "Is it fair that if you get to name the price, that I get to name the terms?" By negotiating with a plan, you can strategically lose many issues that are less important to you, holding out for the one item that is critical to you in the negotiation. It might be the price, the down payment, or the terms of the financing. After you spend considerable time negotiating seriously with the sellers, they become confident that you will buy their house. After you have reached agreement on many points, it is time to negotiate the point or points most important to you. Now you can invoke the doctrine of fairness if necessary, reciting all the concessions that you have made to try to put this deal together. 4. Never bid against yourself. I once sold a house at an auction. There were only a few serious bidders, and one bidder got so excited about buying the house that he bid twice in a row. He bid $65,000, and when no one else acted, he made another bid of $70,000. He raised his own bid, bidding against himself. You may think that this seems funny, but during actual negotiations for a major purchase, such as a house, it is very exciting, and it is easy to raise your own bid. It generally happens when the other party just does not respond to your offer. Silence can be a powerful tool. If you offer the sellers a price for their house and they simply don't respond, what is your reaction? Typically, it is to offer more. A seller who understands this can get you to bid against yourself. I once bought a property from Jim Napier. I made him an offer, and he just looked at me. He said nothing, but I thought his look conveyed that he did not think that the offer was good enough. After what seemed like a long time, I asked him what he thought would be a fair price. He still did not respond, so eventually I offered him a little more, trying to get him to engage in negotiation. His silence eventually forced me to bid against myself. It's a powerful tool, but it takes some practice before you can use it effectively. 5. How to negotiate with an agent. The best deals I have ever made have been brought to me by agents. In Chapter 13, you will learn how to negotiate with and through an agent. 6. When there are two or more sellers and they are hostile to each other. When there is a divorce or another partnership that is breaking up on less than friendly terms, you need to negotiate with the party separately. Sometimes, when an estate is settled, several heirs will end up with a property. They may not even know each other, but it is almost certain that they will have different needs and demands. One may need cash right away and will sell quickly to get it, whereas another will want a higher price and be willing to wait for it. This can become an advantage to a buyer when handled carefully. Anything you say to one party may be communicated to another party, so you want to take the high ground and never disparage the other parties, even though the person you are with may have a lot of ugly things to say. Your job when dealing with multiple sellers is to find out what each one needs and when, and then to structure an offer to buy just the one share on those terms. Then approach the other, or another, heir, as noted in the preceding section on multiple owners. A 20-something heir may want quick cash to buy a new car or take a vacation. You could agree to buy his share at a wholesale price and close quickly. An older heir may want a higher price but be willing to accept payment for her share over a number of years to supplement her retirement income. A third heir may want to occupy the property for a time or even keep an interest in the property, thinking that it will be worth substantially more in a few years. You can make a separate deal with all three. 7. Getting on the same team with the other party. Have you ever made an offer to buy a car from a dealer and have the salesperson leave you to get the approval of a sales manager? What happened? Typically, the salesperson returns with the bad news that he could not give you that much for your trade-in car, or that he could not sell the new car to you for that little, and then he will try to talk you out of more of your money. He blames the other party, in this case his manager, for the higher price and tries to befriend you. He will work hard for you to try to get you the best deal he can. Notice this technique, because it is one of the best negotiating strategies. Rather than set up an adversarial relationship with the buyer, you, the salesperson puts his arm around you, figuratively if not literally, and becomes your ally in this battle against the sales manager. Together, as a team, you will come up with a strategy that the sales manager will accept. The salesperson will become your knight in shining armor and do battle with the enemy until you finally prevail. In the end, the salesperson will congratulate you on being a tough negotiator and for making a great deal. You will go away thinking that you really made a good deal and feel good about your purchase. That is the way a successful negotiation should end. You don't have to worry about the car dealer going out of business. They are professionals, and before they started talking with you, they knew the lowest offer that they would take for the car you bought. Their process is geared toward getting you to pay more than their lowest number. I took my son with me the last time I bought a car and told him what was going to happen at each step of the negotiation. He was pretty impressed that I knew almost exactly what the salesperson would say and what techniques he would use. Buying a car is actually pretty predictable. The salespeople have done it hundreds of times and know what works and what doesn't. The next time you buy a car, pay attention to the salesperson's technique, and rather than playing the role he expects, have a little fun. On a slow day, it can be fun and good practice to drop by a dealership and negotiate to buy a car even if you don't really want to buy one. If it's a slow day at the dealership, the salespeople will be happy for a little practice themselves. And if they are good, they may make you a deal you can't refuse. Be careful, unless you want a new car. The next time you buy a car, do something unexpected and see how the salesperson reacts. After the salesperson comes back with the bad news from the sales manager, rather than increase your bid, ask to use the phone and call somebody. Call a competing car salesperson whose card you brought with you and explain the deal. I guarantee you that that salesperson will promise you a better deal. Now, give your car salesperson one more chance to reduce the price rather than increasing yours. Be nice. Tell the salesperson that you would rather do business with him because you do like his car and his dealership better. Turn the tables on him and get him to bid against himself. If he tells you that he can't do any better, thank him for his time and stand up and start to walk out. Before you hit the door, he will ask you to give him one more chance to get his manager to meet your price. If he thinks that you are ready to buy that day, he won't let you leave without doing his best to make a deal. If you are in the business of buying or selling something, and you have a real customer who wants to do business with you, you don't want that customer to walk away without making a deal. Buyers or sellers who walk away often make a deal with someone else. When you find yourself with a seller who needs to sell, or a buyer or prospective tenant who likes your property, work hard to make the deal now. If they leave to think it over, you rarely will see them again. 8. Know when to walk away. Some sellers are in so much trouble that you may not be able to buy their property even though they desperately need to sell. One seller had several young children, and her spouse had walked out on her. She was months behind in her payments and desperate for some cash to move into a rental property. The lenders would not cooperate, so she had no equity in her house, and there was no profit potential for an investor. In cases like this, it is tempting to pay the seller too much for her house just to help her out. What this seller needs is charity, not for you to pay too much for her house. If you truly want to help, write her a check for moving expenses, but don't buy her house for too much money. Try not to confuse business with charity. Make money in your business operation and then be generous with your charitable gifts. There are a lot of people who need your help. Negotiations and negotiators to avoid. Not everyone plays by the same rules. Some people will do anything to win a negotiation, including lying and outright stealing. It is foolish to think that you can outsmart these people or that you can keep them honest even with a great contract. Avoid negotiating with people you find to be dishonest. Even if they agree to a deal, they will not honor their agreement. They will either refuse to close or they will start negotiating all over again. The great majority of people are honest, and once they have reached an agreement, they will perform as they agreed. If you find yourself dealing with a dishonest person, walk away. It will save you both time and money. When a deal is good enough, quit negotiating and buy. One of the best buyers I ever met was Jack Miller, who said it this way, "Don't steal in slow motion." If a seller is ready to make you a great deal on his property, stop negotiating. Don't ask for anything more. Just accept his offer. To do this, you need to be ready to buy. You need to know what the property is worth, know how to fill out a contract, and know how you will pay for the property. The best deals happen quickly. Selling and buying a house are as much emotional decisions as business decisions. The day the sellers decide to get rid of the house and move on, they will make some buyer a good deal. If you happen to be in the right place at the right time, that could be you, if you have the ability to make the deal right then. Chapter 13. Buying and Selling with Agents. Some of your best buys will be through licensed real estate agents. There is a misconception that agents buy all the good listings. It's not true. In fact, any informed agent knows that it is a conflict of interest to buy his own listing. An agent does not represent his client's best interest by buying that client's property at a bargain price. I use the term agent rather than realtor here because the term realtor is a registered trademark of the National Association of Realtors and refers only to its members. While only some agents are realtors, all realtors are agents. Enticing agents to call you with good deals. How can you convince agents to call you when they find a good deal? use the carrot and stick approach. The carrot, tell the agent that if she brings you a listing that meets your criteria, you always will make an offer. Now, for that offer to be good for the agent, the buyer has to put enough down to pay the commission. Carefully explain what you are looking for. Tell agents that you are looking for an empty house or a house owned by sellers who need to sell this week. Anyone who owns an empty house is getting no benefit from it and probably is worrying about it. These sellers are the most motivated to sell. Buying bigger equities. When I started my investment career, I would look for houses where the price listed was the loan balance plus the commission. My reasoning was that these sellers probably were having trouble making their payments because they would get nothing from the sale but relief from the loan. When I made offers on these houses, there was never enough money to pay a full commission. There are two weaknesses with this strategy. First, you rarely buy much below the market. Second, the agent doesn't remember you fondly because it is unlikely that she was paid a full commission for the sale. A better strategy is to tell agents that you are looking for houses with bigger equities. This will give you more room to negotiate a better price, and it increases the chance that the agent would get paid a full commission. Stress that you have the ability to make a quick decision and could close the sale in a week or less. This will get you a lot of calls in the last days of the listing period. A great time to make an offer. Both the seller and the agent are under pressure to make a deal. The stick in the carrot and stick approach is this. Tell agents that when you find a desperate seller and the agent with the listing has not called you, then the offer may not include enough cash to pay the commission. This is subtle, but they get it. Who to call when you want to buy a listing? Most of us know a number of real estate brokers and salespeople. When you spot a house or an ad for a house that has potential, it is a mistake to call a friend. If they want to get paid, they should be looking for these deals and calling you. When you find a potential bargain, call the listing agent. The agent will receive 2 shares of the commission if she sells her own listing. This extra incentive to put the deal together will have this agent working twice as hard to get it closed. I made a $170,000 offer on a house listed for $225,000. I eventually raised my offer to $175,000, still short of what the seller needed to pay off the loan and pay closing costs. The listing agent agreed to pitch in part of her commission to make the deal work. Paying agents when there is no cash for a commission. Sometimes there is not enough cash in the transaction to pay a commission. Most residential brokers are hoping for a check at the closing. When there is no money to pay them a cash commission, promise to pay them later, perhaps when you resell the property. You can back your promise to pay with a promissory note secured by either the property you are buying or another property that you already own. The top agents in any town make a lot of money. They avoid investing because it is too much trouble. If you make investing easy for them, you may be able to turn things around and collect a check from them at the closing rather than write them one. Look at your agent as a possible investor. Even if they don't have the money today, you flatter them by asking them. Keep in mind that in a normal market, 60 to 70% of listings expire before they sell. If the agent is convinced that this one will not sell, he will be eager to make some deal to get paid something for his efforts, advertising, and so on. One thing Warren Harding taught me was to follow the cash in a transaction. Agents often buy a gift for the new buyer and stay in touch with him. Wrong strategy. The buyer is broke. He just spent it all on the house. Stay in touch with the seller or the agent. They have cash in their pocket and may be potential investors, and the agent may bring you a deal. Buying on lease options through agents. Often the best offer to make on a house is to lease it with an option to buy. How do you pay the broker when you are making a low down payment such as an option payment? Offer to pay the agent part of the fee when the lease option agreement is signed and the balance at the actual closing. You can go a step further and say to the agent and the seller that if you do not close on the purchase, The seller would agree to relist the property with the same agent when the option expires. In this way, the agent gets part of a commission now and will get another full commission when he sells it again. Suppose that a house is listed for $140,000 and you offer to lease it for 4 years, paying $5,000 down as option consideration today. A 7% commission is $9,800. If the agent received 25% of that commission, or $2,450 today, with the balance paid when you exercise the option, this is still far better than not selling the house at all. If the seller is more anxious than the agent, then the agent may negotiate for more of the option payment. Using the different